for downloading the Missouri Review Sound Booth podcast. We're broadcasting from the University of Missouri campus in Columbia, Missouri, home of the Missouri Review, the quarterly that brings you the best contemporary literature in fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. Every week, we'll be featuring a wide range of readings and interviews with writers, editors, and agents.
Hello, this is Carrie Stow, intern at the Missouri Review. It's April 3rd. First up in our month-long Poetry Month podcast series is Don Scher, editor of Poetry Magazine. He was nice enough to sit with me one afternoon and answer some questions. So, all right, I guess the first question I have is fairly personal for you. How did you get started with poetry, not just the magazine, but poetry writing as a thing you do? I know that you also write and translate poetry.
Well, it's a bit of a saga, so I'll compress it.
That's great. No, I completely understand. Yeah, I'm 22 and I feel like I have a book to write already. Yeah.
Yeah, I think most of us do, actually. Well, I wasn't an English major, so I was interested in poetry, but came about it kind of obliquely. I mean, I was always interested in it. I don't know why. I grew up in Memphis, Tennessee, and there weren't any poets I would have known of there at that time. But when I was in high school, Allen Ginsberg came. And like a lot of teenagers, you know, I'd read On the Road, and, you know, I had all the pocket poets. Mm-hmm. Ginsberg and O'Hara and stuff. And seeing Ginsberg was just amazing to me. He was the first living poet I ever laid eyes on. And he was the kind of guy, you know, I talked to him. Mm-hmm. I was 16 or 17 and determined after that conversation that I would leave the South and go to New York.
Oh, wow.
Which I did just to get out.
Yeah.
But once I got to college, I was actually a religious studies major, and I took courses with Elaine Pagels, and mm-hmm. we were reading things like the materials that went into her books, like the Gnostic Gospels, things that were actually from the ancient Near Eastern world, very much like what, you know, the skills required to think about that stuff mm-hmm. Are very much like the skills you bring to reading and thinking about poetry.
Yeah.
And in the course of that kind of stuff, I was reading the Epic of Gilgamesh, sort of touching on ancient, you know, ancient Near Eastern poetry and mm-hmm. religious texts. Then it sort of grew from there. But because I wasn't an English major, I had to educate myself. And once I kind of got out of college, I had a lot of weird jobs. You know, I didn't know what I was going to do. And I ended up working in libraries for a while. Mm-hmm. And the great thing about poetry and libraries is that poetry books are never checked out. So they're always on the shelf.
It's so true.
So I would have these jobs and I would just read my way through the entire poetry collections of these different libraries. In the old days, you know, there was funding in this country to bolster library collections. So mm-hmm. these poetry collections were really terrific, just enormous, wonderful things. And it was sort of a gold mine of sort of material for my self-education. And because I didn't know very much, I kind of read from A to Z, you know, from Ashbery to Zhukovsky.
Yeah, exactly.
And I had no particular, like, biases or inclinations. I had to decide for myself what I was looking at, whether it was good, what, you know, what period it came from, what that meant. And it was this took place over a period of some years where I had jobs that in some ways weren't very good, but were really good for this. And then, of course, you go from there to sort of doing it yourself. And at one point, I had written a poem good enough to show somebody. So, of course, I thought of Ginsberg. A lot of people did this. So I mailed this poem to Ginsberg, and he wrote me back.
Oh, wow.
Which amazed me, but he always wrote people back. And when I got it, he sent the poem back, and everything was crossed out.
Oh, wow.
But you could see it was crossed out like in increments, like he crossed out a bit up here, then a bit down there, and eventually a lot of the poem was crossed out. And at the bottom he wrote, "Oh, I guess you'll have to start over." That was my first poetry lesson.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
So that's kind of where it started. Mm-hmm. Sort of a fun story. I always feel like I should choose my words a little carefully for some reasons that are obvious and some that aren't. But through one thing and another, I started doing editorial work when I was really young, doing, you know, the usual, you know, sort of assistant, editorial assistant, you know, way down on the bottom, volunteer work at the old Partisan Review, which I ended up staying at for 18 years until I became its last poetry editor before the magazine was killed off. And I got to know a lot about that and became sort of trained to do editorial work of every description. And eventually, you know, I was hanging around with people who started literary magazines, like Jenny Barber starting Salamander in Boston. And I had little versions of my own here and there that came and went. And eventually I became a curator of poetry at Harvard. And out of that program was Harvard Review, where I was the poetry editor there. So after sort of a long odyssey, bouncing around and finding my way in poetry, I ended up with this fantastic, lovely job at Harvard, which I sort of never wanted to leave. But a few years after Chris Wyman took over as editor of poetry, the word got out that they were looking for another staff person. And I think out of curiosity, I just sort of inquired about it. And it was the beginning of this long, amazing, and strange conversation. At that time, Chris was new, and he was doing things to sort of revitalize the magazine. And as often is the case, it was sort of getting under people's skin. You know, people had all kinds of different opinions about it. And we were talking, I think, on the phone. Eventually, it became sort of an interview process for this job. And I sort of told him what I really thought, because I figured I might as well be honest with these guys. And I wasn't too happy with some of the things at the magazine. And the gist of one of these conversations was, well, will you come to Chicago and like say that to our face? So I did. And I had never met Christian Wyman and, you know, sort of only knew things I heard here and there. But when we met, the interesting thing was that we were almost like complete opposites, our tastes, our views. And yet at the same time, it seemed like we were long lost weird brothers. Mm-hmm. Chris grew up in the middle of nowhere too, Snyder, Texas.
Oh, wow.
And for whatever reason, we started just talking, and I realized, you know, I've never had this feeling before, but there was something really compelling about him, and he was an inspiration. And right off the bat, we sensed there was a chemistry there. So after a long search process at Poetry Magazine, they sort of shaped a job for me, which was called senior editor. And I remember when Chris told me that he wanted me to come to Chicago and work for Poetry Magazine, I mean, it was a dream come true in a lot of ways. It was something I couldn't believe. And yet I had this sort of great situation. I'd lived in Boston for a long time and couldn't imagine going anywhere else. And I think he sensed my being sort of hesitant, and he sort of put his hand in the crook of my arm and he said, sometimes it's good to shake things up. And I realized, you know, that was really true. He kind of saved me from staying in a job like for decades on end or something. But it was a wonderful moment. And in that instant, what I realized was between Chris and meeting the other wonderful people on the magazine staff, it's a very tiny staff, just four or five people at any time. And two of those folks, Valerie Johnson and Fred Sasaki, are still here working with me. But when I met those guys, I just thought, these are the coolest, strangest, finest, most wonderful people I ever met. And all self-taught, you know, in the sort of art and skill of putting a magazine together. And I just thought, well, I've got to do this. Mm-hmm. And so I've been here ever since.
Well, that's great. So when you took over editorship, did you have any ambitions to change things?
Yes, I did. Yeah. It's a funny thing. When Chris and I started working together in 2007, what evolved was that we were sort of co-editing the magazine. I mean, he was the editor, but in actual fact, and he would say this and people would realize this, we were co-editing the magazine. Mm-hmm. And so it was a great sort of way that it was a complementary relationship. There was sort of things Chris was into and things I was into, and it was sort of a great mixture, a great amalgamation. But it was a collaboration, and we worked together, and he was still the man whose name was at the top of the masthead. But over that period of time, although I managed to do quite a lot of what I had wanted for Poetry Magazine, There were a lot of things that, you know, that we weren't going to do in that configuration for all kinds of reasons. And in the back of my mind, though, I never, you know, I wasn't dangling for anything. In fact, when the job came open on Chris's departure, I had to apply for it like everybody else and be interviewed. And there were finalists and people who nearly got the job. You know, it wasn't a shoo-in thing. They did a real search that took about 5 or 6 months, you know. But it's fair to say that I had absolutely, yes, evolved notions of what I might do if I could and what Poetry Magazine could be, which evolved kind of out of a combination of the sense of magazine's own history and the place of literary magazines in our culture, and also just kind of stuff I took it upon myself to dream about. And so when I got the job, I mean, you know, I've my first issue was in October, and we're sort of starting to move into the direction of the territory I hope to bring the magazine into, and then we'll see what happens.
Yeah, and you wrote that that wonderful sort of introduction to the to that issue. It's not the at the beginning, but it's near the end. But your sort of vision with it, which I thought was really nice, and also a nice change just to see the editor sort of reaching out like that. I thought that was great. Also, the fact that C.A. Conrad, Hannah Gamble, and Heather Crystal were being published in poetry.
Well, it was a shot across the bow, but that was a part of the direction I wanted to go in, and making the magazine much more diverse in every sense of the word, aesthetically, but also in terms of the backgrounds of the poets. But also, well, you know, there's a lot I think people can see just from what's in there that wasn't. But at the same time, it's a very, you know, it's a pretty big commitment. It's a commitment I have to sort of refreshing and reinventing the magazine without trashing its history, which is, you know, important, whatever anybody
A very thinks. Long history as well, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, nobody wants to be the editor who runs it into the ground or wrecks it. So, you know, I have to think constantly about the relationship between sort of my dreams and aspirations on behalf of the poets I want to be in the magazine, and then sort of where my predecessors went and how it worked for them. And you can't help but think, you know, like, what are people going to make of this in 10, 15 years or more? I mean, you know, it's sort of something, you know, where you're always looking over your shoulder a little bit, but I try to look forward more than, I said that in the piece, it's sort of a Janus-like thing where you're looking behind you and ahead at the same time, which is how you'd want to drive a car, but it's a good way to edit. But mostly I'm trying to look ahead.
I'm also really impressed with the, in the latest issue of Poetry, you have a piece by Jeffrey Brown from PBS NewsHour and also Slavoj Žižek, which is...
Great combination, eh?
Yeah, great combination. bold combination, but also very, I feel, useful combination. I feel like that sort of outside take on poetry in general is beneficial to poetry and also what people's conceptions of what poetry is and what poetry can do as well. So then moving into that, what do you think the state of poetry readership is today? I realize that's it's a very large large question and also a large thing to tackle. But I imagine as an editor, you do think about that quite a bit.
Well, you can't help but think about it. We, as everybody hears me say at this point, we get 120,000 poems submitted a year. So that's not the whole of it. You know, there are sort of subterranean things, people who don't send work to a place like Poetry or would never do it, or people who aren't sending work anywhere, you know. But on balance, you get a sense at any given moment of what kind of stuff is going on out there. But as far as what the state of it is, I can only generalize, you know.
Yeah.
Some friends of mine recently were at an event where they were talking about what the future of poetry, of poetry. And it's kind of funny because it's a crazy subject. I mean, the future of poetry is here now.
Yeah.
I mean, we're, you know, this is it. This is as far ahead of as we can get into the future. If you wait long enough, it happens. You know, you'll be part of it if you want to be. And so predicting things is difficult. And so similarly, just sort of further back on the spectrum, it's very hard to say what the state of it is. I mean, it's hard to make useful generalizations. But that said, it feels like an exciting time to me. And I've been around editorially long enough to have been through different kinds of phases, some exactly. of which were very grim. Mm-hmm. You know, print magazines were starting to falter and mm-hmm. topple over like old trees at the end of their lifespan, you know. And I think, you know, one could wonder, say, in the 80s and 90s, whether literary magazines had a future or not. Uh-huh. But now, as far as the state of things goes, I mean, it's very exciting. We have print magazines, which are doing very well. Print is doing fine. It's, in the digital realm, things are great. So, I mean, you know this. Here we are doing exactly what I'm about to describe.
Exactly.
But we have social connections that poets and readers never had before. Mm-hmm. There's interactiveness of a wonderful kind all the time. I mean, that's why I live on Twitter. You know, and that's where I sort of saw you and the Missouri yeah. Review doing things. And in a way, we were sort of in touch, even if we don't agree or people are doing different things or having sort of loud disagreements at any mm-hmm. given time. What's exciting for me is that there's so much going on and that it's possible to take it in. It's possible mm-hmm. to be there, to feel that it's alive and present every hour of the day somewhere in the world, every minute, you know. And to me, that, you know, I don't know, you know, where all this goes, but at the present it feels terrific. It just mm-hmm. feels so exciting. It helps you feel that poetry and poetry magazines are part of the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, they just are. We're out there. We hear what people think, whether they like something or don't. You hear from people who send work your way.
Yeah.
You meet people. It's a wonderful feeling. I imagine my predecessors lived in a completely different world where it was a black box, you know. No one would have met the editor of poetry, really, you know, I started sending poems, I think, to John Frederick Mims, mm-hmm. you know, and I would never have met him or seen mm-hmm. him. And, you know, I wouldn't have gotten to know anything about him or how things were decided at a poetry magazine. It was behind the scenes and sort of very lofty, you know, people making important decisions. And what feels so healthy about it all is that they think things are pretty transparent. Mm-hmm. Vita is a great example of this. If you mm-hmm. do things, people are paying attention and they have something to say about it. You know, people always, you know, go through the ritual of complaining, say, about things like AWP or writers' conferences, and yet we go to meet each other and to find out what's happening. So in terms of both electronic reality, digital reality, which it is reality, and then, you know, the face-to-face meetings that we get, what happens is when I'm at AWP and run into somebody I've only known online, there they are. And it is as if we've known each other, but
exactly.
there are constantly new directions mm-hmm. in our work that we can share with people. And in some way, I think maybe there are losses involved, the sort of privacy, intimacy that someone like an Emily Dickinson would have experienced, where you don't have the pressure bearing down on you all the time. And yeah. some of that pressure isn't good, the pressure to be like people you want to admire mm-hmm. or like you, which social media ramps up. But you can find privacy if you want it.
Sure. Sure.
I think most of us do a combination of that. We mm-hmm. go off, try to do our thing, and then we're out in the world. So to me, the state of sort of poetry in an ecological sense seems very positive and healthy mm-hmm. in terms of the kinds of poetry that are out there and what will come of them. Man, you never know. Mm-hmm. During our centennial, Chris and I read 100 years of the magazine to work on this anthology. We put together 100 poems mm-hmm. and it's a crazy thing to do. But what you realize is that at any given time, a lot of what goes on, the state of poetry is sort of bad. Like there's a lot of poems that don't hold up too yeah. well, and you know, just like, whoa, glad that didn't last. And then of course there are the touchstones that just, you know, from Prufrock on, that seem yeah. to be with us no matter what.
Yeah.
And so it's reassuring that you don't actually have to, I think you don't have to worry about this question too much, because certain things will come of our moment. Mm-hmm. They will survive us and be useful to other readers and writers who come along after us. And that's what you can hope for. The stuff that's just froth sort of or on the surface of things or trendy or some kind of, you know, baloney.
Yeah.
But that stuff will just be gone and no one will think about it unless you're like writing papers about what it was like to be around in 2014.
Which you never know.
You never know.
And then one final question. whether if they've been published in poetry or not, do you have any new kind of young poets you're most excited about?
Well, you know, naming names is always a hard thing.
Yeah.
So you know, the best way to put it, it sounds so terrible, but the young poet I'm excited about is the young poet. It's sort of like the sign in the Cracker Barrel or something. Great. But it's like the poet I haven't met yet, the poet mm-hmm. whose work I haven't seen yet. I think everybody can see that in my issues of the magazine, there are many younger poets who've never been in the magazine before. And that makes me very happy, and I'm very proud of that, and that will continue. So a partial list, if you're looking for names, can be found in the issue starting with October and continuing as long as I'm here, however long that is. But seriously, I mean, we're in the work of discovery, mm-hmm. those of us who do this kind of thing. And so, you know, I'm always waiting to see work from somebody that just appears magically in front of me in the submission system. And I just say, wow, you know, this is an exciting person, a person just starting out, and look at, you know, already they're doing this fantastic work. So I get the opportunity every day to discover exciting new poems, but to name them, you know, I would start with the people I've published and I'm in the process of publishing. Yeah, and I would say exactly. Those guys are good, but there are many more to come. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are many people I would like to see in the magazine, you know, but I think they have to sort of figure out if they want to be in it and send work my way. So if you're out there, young poets, yes, send work my way, because that's what I want to read. But I mean, that said, people are always very curious about younger poets, but there are all kinds of other poets. You know,
sure.
For the most part, in a submission system, I don't know how old anybody is or who they are, where they come from. Some, obviously, sometimes you do. But I'm equally excited about finding great work from poets who've long careers behind them, poets who are sort of mid-career, poets at any stage. But there is that special excitement about having a younger poet sort of be brought to attention. I mean, you mentioned a few people in the October issue. It's very exciting, you know, to have people like that featured in mm-hmm. in Poetry Magazine. It's like the greatest part of my jobs. And of course, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the Ruth Lilly Fellowships, which specifically, I'm not plugging them, but they specifically exist, you know, to help support the work of younger poets under the age of 31. And so that's another way that that the magazine exists, really to support all kinds of work, but with a special affection, you could say, for the work of younger writers.
Mm-hmm. Well, great. Thank you very much, Don, for speaking with me.
Thank you, Carrie. I'm so glad you found me.
It's been a pleasure. I look forward to retweeting you and subtweeting you in the future.
Same here.
You have been listening to the Missouri Review's Sound Booth podcast. Stay tuned later this month as we talk to other poetry editors and celebrate the joy of Poetry Month. Check us out online as well at MissouriReview.com. For info on subscribing to our magazine and our Poem of the Week feature, I'm Carrie Stowe.